that would help working people because the sales tax impacts working people. I'm currently the vice chair of the Committee on Community Development and Small Businesses, and one of the bills that we heard testimony on in the last session was something I call LLC Light. And the vast majority of small businesses on the North Shore in the Merrimack Valley have fewer than 20 employees. So these are very small businesses. And in those instances where you have sole proprietors, if we were able to reduce the annual fee for LLCs, for limited liability corporations, right now it's $500 a year, if we were able to have a reduced fee for those very small businesses, I think that's a common sense step that would be helpful to our small businesses.
So, this will be more of a discussion than we were able to have last week when we had five candidates in the studio. So reducing that fee, it removes kind of a speed bump that businesses face when they want to go into business.
Sure. There are right now built-in costs of doing business in Massachusetts, and what we have to do is look at those menus of fees and costs and find out if some of them are unnecessary obstacles where there's no value added that hurts our state's positioning to not only attract businesses, but how do we help startups? How do we assist when people want to hire new people, but that's very daunting for them? So I've definitely taken the past 19 months of this term to find out who the contacts are in the various related state agencies. And also, just recently had a small business roundtable in Haverhill, invited businesses from across the Merrimack Valley to sit down with me and Treasurer Steve Grossman, who's expert on access to capital issues, which is a big issue when businesses want to be able to grow their businesses or buy equipment, things of that nature. So if I have the opportunity at every single tack, whether it's on the ground, listening to, firsthand, I'm not going to assume what the challenges are when the small businesses can tell me directly what they are and get me to work. And I've also urged them in the next session, when we hear testimony on the bills that are filed, that's the opportunity in January and February. If there's any legislation that they're pushing for, that's when to file it. And I can file it on their behalf. I can let them know when hearings are scheduled, and that they can actually have a seat at the table and talk to the members of the Small Business and Community Development Committee.
It's really important, and you highlighted this, all of your towns are along the New Hampshire border, mm-hmm. and there is that kind of, I've been known to go to Seabrook to buy some things, there is that kind of cross-border travel to, mm-hmm. to avoid sales tax. Mm-hmm. How long has the new sales tax been in effect, do you know?
It was increased when I wasn't in the state Senate, so it was...
More than 2 years ago.
Yes, absolutely. It was about 3 or 4 years ago when it upped to 6.25%. And, there's different mechanisms on the book. We have a trigger mechanism that reduces the income tax, depending on the economic climate. So the income tax went down by a tiny percentage in this last fiscal year. So there's different pieces of the pie. Right now, our tax base is largely income tax based versus sales tax based. But the other creative things that we can do is in the instance of artisans and the creative economy, there is the opportunity to study whether or not we're able to have art and craft that are made in Massachusetts be sales tax free, to be a boost for tourism so that we can attract area communities to shop in our local downtowns. A lot of the stores, whether it's Newburyport, Amesbury, Haverhill, North Andover, a lot of the shops that are in our downtowns are often artisans, artists, and people making their own craft and their own goods. So I think that we could have a serious discussion about a pilot making it possible for those items to be sales tax free to get that foot traffic in our downtowns.
All right, moving on. Public education might be the most important function that government serves, in my opinion. As our state senator, please identify your top goal related to improving state funding of local public education, how that goal might be achieved, and how you believe public education may be bettered for as many students as possible.
Mm-hmm. So even though Massachusetts ranks first in the nation for public education standards, I know that we have a ton of work to do, starting with the foundational problem of the Chapter 70 funding formula. And in this last legislative session, the legislature unanimously took the first step of reconvening the Foundation Budget Review Committee. And that's a big deal because it hasn't been reconvened since education reform in 1993 because of that fear of having winners and losers and reallocating how the pie is divided. So they actually have to convene with four meetings. The first one already happened at the State House. And they have to make really concrete recommendations in terms of what's broken with the system. And I know right off the bat that it's too complicated. If you don't understand it, how can you advocate for what's wrong with it and how to improve it? And only a handful of experts in the Department of Education can actually articulate the formula itself. And that's problematic. I don't think it has to be that complicated. There's a number of things related to this Chapter 70 funding. The fact of the matter is Chapter 70 makes part of the broader local aid. When people talk about we have to increase local aid, that's very true. But local aid also encompasses Chapter 70 funding. And since the Great Recession, we haven't been able to catch up with those levels of Chapter 70 funding, and that has to be recognized. So even though we increased Chapter 70 by over $100 million, now it's at least an additional $25 a student. That's significant. So it's trending in the right direction, but it's not like we can just dust our hands off and say we're good and this is the new normal. We have to incrementally increase that. And the other thing that I've learned in my role as the state senator is going to the seven communities, meeting with the various school committees, including the technical schools, including the regional schools. And the consistent problem is the unsustainable and unpredictable way that we fund special education. So the state has a serious role to play. And what I did was I created a working group focused on special education funding that meets once a month. And we rotate among the different communities so that we can actually be in other people's home turf and they can meet each other. So we have special education instructors. We have the parents of special education students, administrators, teachers, school committee members, talking about what works and what doesn't work. And our end goal is to offer specific recommendations to both the education committee and the legislature and be able to file my own legislation proposing some short-term changes, because we have long-term changes that have to happen with each budget cycle, and then short-term changes.
Well, I'm glad to hear you talk about short-term changes, because unlike a lot of other things in government, education reform in the long term, although helpful, doesn't help the students that are there right now.
Exactly.
I have students that are in high school, and long-term things won't even hit until they're in college or beyond.
Absolutely. Especially when we talk about things like the reduction in extracurricular activities and curriculum options, including foreign language. We have too many fees across the board to participate in things like sports or chorus. And there's
Tell me about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it all adds up. And we're going in the wrong direction in that sense. So when it comes to special education funding, one role that the state can play is to fund the transportation costs related to special education funding. The other thing that's come up along the various debates we've had in the general election is the topic of charter schools. And my opponent, when we have the various debates and you have about 1 minute to talk about a very complex issue, has taken the opportunity to try to make a wedge issue of charter schools in this general election. And if we're going to have an honest dialogue about charter schools, you know, he was trying to say that I want to, you know, take away the charter school option, and he's saying I've said that their time has passed. If you look at this honestly, it all comes back to Chapter 70 funding and the lack of funding to have a robust public education system. I'm obviously not interested in taking away people's charter school option. The fact of the matter is that there's limited opportunity for everyone to participate, and we want all of the best practices and successes in the charter schools to be able to be implemented at the public school level, but the funding's not there. So I just felt very strongly that, you know, I'm going to be frank and not just say, you know, charter schools are great, everything is great, because we can do better. If there are wait lists for charter schools, that means we're not meeting student and parent needs. They want more solutions. And the real truth of the matter is the next legislative session is an opportunity to make progress on that. The Senate took up a bill toward the end of the Senate to raise the cap on charter schools. And the Senate, unlike the House, didn't...
The cap on the number of charter schools or the funding for charter schools?
That's an excellent question. So the cap for new charters and being able to grow the seats in currently chartered schools. So on its face, it might seem straightforward, but the details were that this bill wouldn't have impacted the communities in our district. It was a Boston-based bill because the wait lists are so long in Boston, and it was to increase the cap on charter schools 4 years from now. And it was a very easy vote for me to vote not to raise the cap, because the auditor Bump, was currently in the process of doing an entire auditing report and analysis of some of the issues with the charter schools and where we need to put our attention, which was going to be finished in August, and we were taking that vote in July. So in my opinion, it was premature to take long-term action 4 years from now and be married to that when we were just about to get a report. And that's been distorted over this general election term. And at the end of the day, I always just want to have a frank conversation to focus on the shared goal of having parents feel confident that when they're paying their state taxes and their local taxes, the result of that is an education that they can feel confident in that keeps their child competitive.
I'd like to remind everybody that we did send out multiple invitations to the senator's opponent, Sean Toohey. He did not respond. We would have loved to have had him on the show and to talk about the issues that we're talking about with the senator, but he declined to reply. You're right that Chapter 70 is far too complicated, but in my very basic understanding of it is something that you just brought up. The larger cities, Boston, Springfield, Worcester, don't they have, because of the way the representation works in the state house, don't they have kind of an undue bearing on the funding under Chapter 70?
That hasn't been my experience necessarily. I think there's a greater tension between the fact that you have, you know, the Education Committee, which is comprised of various House and Senate members from various communities.
And their representation kind of sways how...
They have a very strong voice in the pacing of this decision.
Because of the density of the population.
So we have, in every committee, there's always more reps than senators. That's just the way it falls
out.
Yeah, that's just the way it is. There are more reps than senators. There are 40 senators and 160 reps. And I think that the leadership in both the Senate and the House have done a good job of saying, you know, regardless of an individual opinion on a committee level, we have to move this issue forward. And that's what's exciting, because, you know, communities like North Andover are hurting, communities like Newburyport and Amesbury. And if you, you know, not to repeat myself, but if you cannot actually say what the status quo formula is, how can you recommend changes? I know that the resources are there if we're smarter in terms of the priorities. And, you know, it's a question of distribution, yes. But if the overall pie is bigger to distribute, that's a factor as well. And that's another goal to achieve, is how do we improve the efficiencies in issues like special education funding? How do we reduce the unfunded mandates that make those local school budgets have to increase? They're being asked to do so much administrative work, which eats up hours of time, and that's not being compensated for. You know, one anecdote that I can tell you about in terms of unfunded mandates was a request from a Board of Selectmen member in North Andover who said, in our schools, we're getting these letters sent to our children. She called them fat letters, but they were letters saying that we've done the fat density test and your child is over. Or
body mass index and that kind of thing.
There you go.
Yes.
Thank you. That's what she called them. The more professional term is body mass index. So
I like the fat checker.
And, you know, she felt very strongly that even though the state was mandating this test to be conducted by the nurses, there was no money to back that up. You know, just do it. And there was no follow-up. So what's the end goal other than telling a student that they have a problem that there isn't going to be any follow-up on. So we were able to file a bill to try to stop that one unfunded mandate. And there are different paths to get to that end goal. And the change wasn't made through a bill, but the Department of Health changed their regulations so that it wasn't a mandate anymore. And actually, the auditor has an office, an individual in her office who's charged with eliminating unfunded mandates, which is fascinating.
It is fascinating. It's kind of making your job go away. The better you do it makes your job go away, but it's an important job to do. Mm-hmm. Unfunded mandates, it's easy for the legislature to say, you must do this. Mm-hmm. The transportation issue with respect to special education. Mm-hmm. It's required, but it doesn't come back through the Chapter 70 funding. Mm-hmm. So how do cities and towns pay for that? Mm-hmm. They cut curriculum, they cut programs, they cut teachers, they scale back on other things.
And it's interesting to have a dialogue, especially one that involves parents. And they're not necessarily interested in sending their child far away from the community if there are more local options. And things like opportunities through regionalization and having communities that are in closer proximity pool resources to offer services, because there are sometimes unique challenges, whether it's speech issues, very complicated physical issues, and sometimes it's things that can be provided within the district. So, you know, our goal is really over the next couple of months to winnow down the low-hanging fruit in terms of what we can provide to the committee and say, these are some serious short-term solutions to the problem.
So the last question I'll have for you, and I know you do have to get going because it's election day is Tuesday and you have a busy day, but as state senator, your job is to represent your constituents, and as a state senator, those constituents are more broadly dispersed than state representatives or city council from where you came, but a lot of the issues that you need to vote on are complicated and often not well understood by the general population. There are two schools of thought about how an elected official represents his or her constituents. You act in the stead of your constituents, more like a proxy, mm-hmm. and vote as you believe the majority of your constituents would, mm-hmm. or you act as an agent of your constituents, perhaps with a better understanding of the issues, and vote according to what you believe represents a better balance of the interests of your constituents. Discuss your philosophy about that and why you have that philosophy.
It is such a good point, because there are those two approaches. And one, through these 19 months, thinks about that, because you're wrestling with very complicated issues. And sometimes the time frame that we have to make those votes is very compressed. So I actually try to practice a hybrid of the two, because we cannot hear from 160,000 constituents. It's not physically possible. But we do get opinions voiced through email, through the phone, through letters, through my attending events or going food shopping. So I'm going to come across plenty of people to get their opinions on things. I also often like to approach people that are expert on it, whether it's something like special education or tax reform. So I try to become as aware as possible of where people are at. And then I also have the access to specific information in terms of the context of the overarching bill or what is the intention behind something. And a great example of that was the vote to increase the minimum wage. And that was an instance where I always felt that I wanted to increase the minimum wage, and there was going to be a pending ballot question where we have those four questions right now. One of the questions was going to be one related to increasing the minimum wage, and they decided to take that off because we passed legislation to increase the minimum wage. But my position was different than the majority of Democrats in the Senate, because the House version of increasing the minimum wage didn't automatically index it to the consumer price index, and I agreed with that position. The Senate position was to index it, which was identical to the ballot question. And the reason I felt strongly about that is because, you know, area states don't do it that way. And when you have businesses meeting payroll, I believe and very strongly that the minimum wage needed to be increased. But they didn't need that fluctuation of a few pennies up and down, in, you know, all the time to be able to meet that goal. And I wanted to be able to make this increase happen quickly. And if the Senate and the House bills don't match, it goes to committee and it sits there. And that's ultimately what ended up happening is the Senate had their version, which was indexed. The House had their version, which was not indexed to the CPI. And for 6 months, they had to reconcile those differences instead of it just being a straight increase that could help people. So that was a nuanced issue where the challenge was on me to try to communicate where it could easily be twisted into Katie voted against an increase.
You could have done a little better in communicating that early on.
Oh, point taken, point taken. The fact of the matter was we found out that we were going to take this vote up within a matter of days. And I can't control that because I'm not leadership. So it wasn't like there was this ramp up to a policy change. Some folks were thinking it was going to be dealt with on the ballot question. And some folks saw it on the horizon but didn't know. We're taking it up this week. And yeah, point taken. First term legislator lessons.
Well, I know I said that that was the last question, but you talked about the indexed minimum wage. Mm-hmm. And there is a ballot question about an indexed tax with respect to the gas tax. Mm-hmm. Tell us your thoughts about that.
I've been vocal about wanting to repeal that. When I was in the Senate, I voted to not index the gas tax for the exact same reason. I feel that as a legislator, it's incumbent upon us to take those votes. So if there's going to be an increase after the current increase in the minimum wage, let's vote to do that, and then it gets implemented. But once something is automatic, my concern is that there isn't that accountability.
That's true.
And there isn't that public awareness and participation in that decision making. And you're not going to get any argument from me that we need to invest in our infrastructure. I mean, look at the amazing work happening at the Whittier Bridge, at the Methuen Rotary. Good work is getting done. But the 3 cent gas tax indexed to inflation is only anticipated to raise $1 billion over 10 years. And we see in other states, there are much better ways to generate even more revenue where it's not as controversial. Something like this makes people feel like they don't have a voice in the matter. In California, you can use your easy pass in the carpool lanes to circumvent congestion on an as-needed basis. And that's something that people can opt in or out of. You get a benefit for the cost. That money goes toward transportation. And I don't necessarily want to opt for revenue strategies that, you know, fixate in controversy when there's just better opportunities to get to the same end goal and raise even more money.
Thank you for that. Closing statement, I'll give you about a minute just to tell us why you think we should vote for you on Tuesday.
I am humbly asking for people to continue to support me and have confidence in the work that we're doing. We are looking at the first re-election for me in the state Senate, and that is always, I think, a large challenge because even though I've gotten to know many, many people, I haven't met everyone, and not everyone is familiar with my work, but I'm very proud of the track record that I've developed, and whether it's through constituent services or the work I've done with two state budgets under my belt or the legislation that we've passed, there's a track record there of being productive and effective and trying to build consensus, and I definitely want to urge everyone to get to the polls, and I'd be honored to have that vote because the work that happens in the state legislature directly impacts our communities, and I've worked to be very accessible, and hopefully folks know where to find me, but if I can leave my my email address on the air if folks have questions.
Please.
About where
sure.
I stand. So my email address for this campaign is kathleen@voteforives. So vote for Ives, the word for, and you can directly email me there. The website is voteforives.com. And I'm available to answer any questions about the work we've done or forward-looking. And all of the debates are available on my Facebook page, too, which is pretty informative.
Well, Senator Kathleen O'Connor Ives, thank you for coming into Local Pulse to talk about the issues of the upcoming election. Election Day is Tuesday. Go to wheredoivotema.com to learn where to vote, see who's on the ballot. There are a lot of candidates on the ballot. If you haven't checked, you'll be surprised. There are a lot of offices up for election. Thank you so much for coming in. Safe travels today out there. I know you're going to be all over the district, And once again, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for the opportunity.
This is Joe DiBiase. You're listening to Local Pulse on WNBP The Legends. We'll be right back with some folks from the Historical Society of Old Newbury to talk about a really interesting event coming up this Thursday at City Hall here in Newburyport.
What's happening around town from the greatest community station in the nation, WNBP.
The Legends would like you to know the Friends of the Newburyport Council on Aging is collecting books, CDs, and DVDs with Recycle That. The recycling is in a blue-green container at Cushing Park, the corner of Ken and Congress Streets in Newburyport. Please place all donations inside the box. Proceeds from the contributions benefit programs of the Local Council on Aging. And if it's happening in Newburyport, you'll hear about it here on The Legends WNBP. The season has changed and it's time to move from the summer drinks. What does the Home Brew Barn have going on for the fall?
We've been helping winemakers by providing the fresh grapes and juice they need from Napa and Italy. And now the apples are ready, so making hard cider has begun.
That sounds delicious. What's going on with beer makers?
Oktoberfest, pumpkin ales, and holiday porters, of course.
Let them show you how at 861 Lafayette Road, Route 1 in Hampton, New Hampshire, or visit online at thehomebrewbarn.com.
Farley's of Newburyport, formerly John Farley Clothiers, is now open in their new location in the former Chase and Lunt Insurance Building at 47 State Street in Newburyport. Under new ownership, but with the same commitment to fine men's tailored clothing, tuxedo rentals, accessories, and great gift items, Farley's of Newburyport is your destination for top quality men's clothing. Stop in, say hi, and see their great new store and wonderful collection of first quality men's clothes.
People are always looking to invest in a good opportunity. So what if you could invest in the future of kids, like a stock? Not the kind of stock that's about making money, but a stock for social change, called Better Futures. With your investment, it helps students like me go to college. My name is Charles, and I'm your dividend.
Invest in better futures with UNCF. Visit uncf.org/invest. A mind is a terrible thing to waste, but a wonderful thing to invest in. Brought to you by UNCF and the Ad Council.
And we're back on Local Pulse. My name is Joe DiBiase. We've just heard from Senator Kathleen O'Connor Ives. Just to remind everyone, we did invite her opponent, Sean Toohey, to come in and discuss the issues, and he declined to respond. So I just want to make sure that everyone realizes that at Local Pulse, we're very fair, and we try to give all of the candidates an opportunity to speak to the voters. Last week, we had our very successful state rep candidate forum. All five state rep candidates were in the studio. And if you didn't have a chance to listen to the show last week, it's available online. You can listen to the entire show. It's on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/localpulseradio. You might have to scroll down just a little bit to see the instructions on where you can find the recording of the state rep forum. It was, Greg, I think it was probably one of the more successful shows we've done. It was, I've gotten a lot of good word about it. I think we gave all of the candidates an opportunity to speak their mind on a number of issues.
Yeah, I'd like to let everyone know that we did run out of bandages from that last weekend, so we do need some more first aid kits.
It got a little chippy at times, but not so bad.
Oh, it was fun. They were civil.
They were civil, and it was great to have them all here in the waiting room before the show, and had a chance to meet them all and talk a little bit before we got started. WNBP will be providing live coverage of the elections this Tuesday from Newburyport, former Mayor Mary Carrier. And we'll be talking about Mary in just a moment, but Mary Carrier will be covering election results live from Newburyport City Hall. WNBP's Mary Beth Parkinson will be covering the live election results from Amesbury. And I'll be up in Salisbury providing live election coverage as they come in for the local elections. So Tune in to WNBP Tuesday night. Live election coverage should begin shortly after 8 when the polls close. And I believe you'll know first who won, at least won the state rep campaign or election by listening to WNBP, The Legends. So we were talking about Mary Carrier, who will be providing election coverage on Tuesday. Mary's a former mayor of Newburyport, and we have with us right now from the Historical Society of Old Newbury, Kathy Strauss and Bruce McCoy, who are on the program committee running a forum this Thursday at Newburyport City Hall. And Kathy, why don't you tell us a little bit about the forum? It's a really unique event.
It is unique, and I think it's the first time something like this has happened in Newburyport. The Historical Society is so proud to sponsor this. This is our gift to the city for its 250th. We're going to have a reception on the second floor at City Hall beginning at 6, and then all mayors from 1968, from Byron Matthews on, will be on the auditorium stage in a panel discussion moderated by Sheriff Frank Cousins. It should be an absolutely fascinating evening. It is open to all. We would really love to see a full attendance there to take advantage of this wonderful gift. So, and also, I think it's sort of a way of, you know, we talk about the 250th, but then here's history in the making. And something we all can appreciate, how this office of mayor shaped the city that we so love.
So all living, present, and former mayors will be there. It's a forum moderated by Sheriff Frank Cousins. Bruce, tell us what you expect the topic of discussion to be and how things are going to go.
Well, I think it's going to be a very good discussion. We were able to get together with Frank Cousins. We had a nice meeting with him. His knowledge of the city and the mayor is incredible, and we came up with a broad line of questions. Everything from what was the greatest crisis you faced when office, what's your greatest memory, right down the line. I think with Frank's knowledge of the mayors and friendship with the mayors, it's going to turn into a great night. I think it'll be a lot of fun. I think it's going to be interesting, and I think you'll find some pretty good anecdotal stories as well.
Yeah. So it's free and open to the public. Yep. It's this Thursday at Newburyport City Hall. What time?
We have a reception at 6, and then the event starts at 6:30.
So. Whose idea was it? It's a great idea. I don't think I've ever seen this kind of an event anywhere.
Well, we have a programs committee at the Historical Society. There's four of us, Martha Bauer, Lois Vallejo, Kathy, and myself. And we sit down once a month and just start brainstorming. And, you know, we brought up the fact that we're a city that's very fortunate in the fact that we have a living history of our mayors, going back, you know, to Byron Matthews, who was very influential in, you know, bringing the city where it is today. And each mayor left their footprint on that.
So, really? From just after the time we landed on the moon, you've got all mayors here.
Right.
Yeah.
So it started off as just an idea. We had a couple more meetings on it. Then the concept came up, who would be a moderator? Well, how about Frank Cousins? He knows all the mayors. Frank's a very, very good friend to the Historical Society. And, you know, it just turned out the reception from City Hall, the reception from the mayors is positive. And I think they're just as excited about it as we are.
So two former mayors will be joining us on Local Pulse next week to do an election wrap. It'll be John Moak and Mary Carrier. Mm-hmm. They'll be on the show this coming Saturday to talk about the election. So they're getting a lot of play this week. Mm-hmm. Tell us about some other programs that the Historical Society is thinking about, is mm-hmm. promoting. And why don't you go with this, Kathy?
Well, we've sort of hit our stride with local programming. We've had in the past year, for example, Boys of Joppa, again, Sheriff Cousins and Ian Lucy. Terrific. It was an intimate evening, but it was, geez, at least 100 people. And then we went to the Neptunes. We like to partner up with other groups. The mayors, of course, but the thing is, of course, is to find something that's appealing to everybody. and then to certain segments. Lois, for example, is an amazing textile historian. She put together a program on wedding dresses, which is second to none. And that was fabulous. And that's what we try to do in the future. We're going to be doing some maybe more intimate evenings on immigrants. We're thinking about hops and history, beers, artisanal.
Okay, we're in.
Invite me to that one.
We're in.
Yeah, okay. That'll be sometime next October. But it's Bruce pointed out, we just all get together and we start brainstorming.
I wonder how the idea of hops came up.
Bruce
might have had something to do with that.
That could have been. But also, it always comes back to the society itself, which isn't just, it's a house museum, but it's got a lot of different aspects to it. Beautiful collections, silver samplers. We've got the largest Laura Coombs Hills collection of paintings in the United States under our roof. It's beautifully housed, beautifully exhibited, not just her watercolors for flower arrangements and whatnot, but there's a full figure of a woman in front of a kitchen break front, which is quite unusual, as well as a seascape, which is really unusual for her. And she is, of course, Newburyport's premier painter, as you can find out from maybe talking to Sandy Lepore, who is, of course, the great chronicler of her life and her work. She's very knowledgeable. We go along those veins, and then we branch out into others, you know, that's unexpected for us. We want to be not inclusive as such a overworked word, but we want everyone to find something there that would appeal to them because it draws them to the city that we love.
So, Bruce, Kathy brings up an interesting point. It is a house museum, mm-hmm. but it's a membership-driven organization.
Right.
How can someone learn more about the Historical Society of Old Newbury and become a member if they were so inclined?
Well, there's a couple ways you can. The easiest way is just to Google Historical Society of Old Newbury. Everything pops up. Our website will pop up. Anybody can become a member. For an individual member, it's as low as $30. For a family, it's $50, and that opens you up to all our events, our newsletters, and whatnot. I think one thing we really should stress too is that the Cushing House isn't the only part of our museum. It's actually a campus. You can go into the gardens that are beautiful year-round. And we also have the Mint Building, which is behind the Cushing House, which we're currently in the process of restoring. So we have a campus, and it's not just a museum. It's a living campus. So
the Cushing House is located?
On High Street, 98 High Street, Kathy?
It's 98. It's a corner of High and Fruit. Right across from Martha Bauer.
And
it's the Historical Society, it's not the Commerce Department. Or they don't know where they actually reside.
Exactly.
So the website address is newburyporthist.org,
yes.
But you can Google it, as Bruce says. And tell us a little bit more about the event on Thursday. By the way, we're talking with Kathy Strauss and Bruce McCoy. They're on the program committee at the Historical Society of Old Newbury, and they're sponsoring and hosting an event this Thursday, November 6th, with all the former and present mayors of Newburyport. Five in total, or six?
Six
or seven.
Yeah. So why don't you run down the list of the mayors? I hope you have them in front of you.
Let's see. It's Byron Matthews, Lisa Mead, Mary Carrier, John Moak, Donna Holliday.
Chris Sullivan.
So that's six.
Al Lavender.
Seven.
Yeah.
And Donna Holliday makes.
Yeah.
So I think that's seven. And the setup is going to be?
It's actually going to be a very interesting setup. We were talking with Frank about how we're going to set the stage up. And Frank came up with a very good idea, is that we will pull each mayor's chair from the city council room and set it up on stage. So it brings a little more history to it, you know, where they started on the city council.
They're all former city councilors.
Yes.
And eventually became mayor.
Mm-hmm.
And it covers six decades.
It covers in a very influential period in Newburyport. If you look at Newburyport in 1968 compared to now, it's a much different city. So I think it's going to be very interesting getting each mayor's perspective on the city at that time and where it's going today.
Whose idea? I mean, I know you have the program committee, but whose idea was the mayor forum?
I would give Kathy most of the credit on that. She's
that's very big of you, Bruce.
She's the one who threw the idea out,
and it's a great idea.
Yeah.
Welcome reception from all the invitees.
So far, wow. Yes. Yes.
Yeah, I went to City Hall, I think it was Monday, basically just to see about logistics, the chairs and things like that. People could not have been more welcoming. And the thing I really struck me was they're delighted to have this done. I thought that they would think after an election, the last thing they wanted to do was all get together again. But that's not true.
They'll change their mind Wednesday.
I think it was the town clerk had all these stories. He's just percolating. He's dying to tell. And you think, and you get there and you start thinking about these other programs that can happen, you know, if these walls could talk, City Hall, that kind of thing.
Well, speaking of someone who knows the history of Newburyport, City Clerk Richard Jones, yeah. I mean, not only from his governmental position as city clerk, but former city solicitor and historical painter. What a talent we have in that office.
Oh, absolutely.
It's really
absolutely
amazing. Let's get back a little bit more to the Historical Society in general. It's open to the public.
Yes. Yeah.
And you have archives that are available for research. And tell us a little bit about that.
Right. We have a research library. Anybody can come in and use it, pull documents. It's literally the history of the city. You know, we have photos of, you know, every period of town. We just bought acquired a collection of 3,000 pictures from Chris Snow that go back 100 and some odd years. It's a great collection, mm-hmm. and we're really looking forward to getting that on display.
That's a wonderful thing, too, about the Historical Society. Bruce's mention of the photographs. Yes, there are 3,000 of them. A lot of them, people don't even know what they are. But there is a great band of volunteers there at the Society who are working hard to identify them. We've got a wonderful collection of people who are our docents and tour guides during the time of the year. So, I mean, it's not just you can come. Certainly, we welcome you to come and attend a program. Please do. But there's a way to become a real active participant there and really do some, you know, some research or whatever happens to be your passion. I mean, maybe Lois, for example, with her wedding dresses. Maybe it's material cultures that you want to work on. Maybe it's samplers. Maybe it's whaling. There are all sorts of things where you could put your expertise on.
And it doesn't have to be your passion. You could just be curious.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
And it's a great way to develop a passion is by going in and just kind of nosing around.
Yeah.
So any last thoughts on the Mayor's Forum or, you know, why don't you run down the schedule of it and where it's going to be so everyone knows. We're talking with, by the way, Bruce McCoy and Kathy Strauss. They're on the program committee at the Historical Society of Old Newbury. So, Bruce, why don't you tell us about the event again just so people that are tuning in and out get all the details.
All right. So the program's called An Evening with the Mayors. It's Thursday, November 6th at 6 o'clock. The reception starts at 6 o'clock in the City Hall Auditorium, and the forum begins at 6:30. Again, it's all the living mayors in Newburyport, and the moderator will be Frank Cousins.
So that's at Newburyport City Hall this Thursday. You know, we'll know who all our new elected officials mm-hmm. are, and mm-hmm. and everyone will
that's
be taking, yeah. And the mayor's not up for re-election this year, so there's no new mayor.
Right.
But we'll know who our state representative is, our state senator, and we'd like to thank the Historical Society of Old Newbury for sponsoring this event. It's free and open to the public. And Bruce and Kathy and your whole entourage that's out in the waiting area. Thank you so much for coming into Local Pulse this morning to talk about this event. It's Thursday,
right.
November 6th, 6 p.m., City Hall Auditorium in Newburyport.
Correct.
Thanks so much for coming in. We'll be right back with
thank
our favorite butcher,
us.
Joe Bucciarelli from Bucciarelli's in Salisbury, right here on Local Pulse on WNBP.
I am watching you leave. The fire dies inside of me. I know it'll be a while until I see you again. Days,
Hello, I'm Bob Malik. November has arrived, and this week we'll look back at the band's history in this, the 11th month of the year. George gets deported, Brian Epstein's first encounter with the band, and the recording of their first number one song. You'll hear those stories and more as we look back at November's past, this week on The Beatle Years.
Tune in for The Beatle Years this Sunday morning at 10 and only on The Legends.
If you're looking for an outstanding pizza this weekend, then look no further than the award-winning Nick's Pizza in Newburyport. For over 60 years, Nick's Pizza has made a bakery-style Italian square pizza with a wide variety of toppings. Try Nick's Pizza and see why people, young and old, have enjoyed this local favorite throughout the years. Order Nick's Pizza on the phone or online for easy pickup or delivery. Nick's Pizza, 164 Merrimack Street, Newburyport, 978-465-9853.
Are you a cocktail person? Then experience the taste of cocktails made from the Smoky Quartz Distillery in Seabrook, a micro-distillery veteran-owned and operated by Kevin Curlin, using local grains, fermented locally, and made with pure New Hampshire spring water. Even the name is local, Smoky Quartz, New Hampshire's official gemstone. Stop at the distillery for a taste of our solid granite vodka. Right now, it's only available for sale in New Hampshire, which means you can buy it at our distillery at 894 Lafayette Road, Route 1 in Seabrook, online at smokyquartzdistillery.com. Please drink responsibly.
And we're back on Local Pulse. My name is Joe DBAs. You're listening to WNBP, The Legends. Don't forget a couple of things happening. Right now, there is an Emergency Management Services mock disaster drill happening over in Amesbury. So don't be alarmed, but don't try to go to the high school because the parking lot is closed for another couple of hours. And it is a drill in conjunction with some other area departments and Anna Jakes Hospital. So nothing to be concerned about, but don't go over to Amesbury High School parking lot. Don't forget to turn your clocks back tonight. So before you go to bed, turn your clocks back, and you're going to get an extra hour's sleep. The downside is it's going to be dark so early tomorrow. Tuesday is Election Day. And if you want to hear last week's state representative candidate forum for the 1st Essex District, go to our Facebook page. It's facebook.com/localpulseradio. And you'll be able to, you might have to scroll down a little bit, but you'll see instructions on where you can hear last week's state representative candidate forum. And what I've been saying to people is you're gaining an hour this weekend with the clocks being turned back. Take that hour and educate yourself about the upcoming election. It's a big election statewide. A lot of constitutional officers in Massachusetts are up for election. U.S. Congress, U.S. Senate, state Senate, state representative. In Newburyport, there are 5 ballot questions. A lot of people aren't aware that there's a non-binding referendum question that asks if we should instruct our new state representative to vote in favor of legislation to regulate marijuana in the same way that we regulate alcohol. So that's a non-binding referendum question number 5. The 4 other questions, they've received a lot of press, and you've probably seen a lot of television commercials about them. But go to wheredoivotema.com, put in your address, and the sample ballot will come up right in front of you with all 4 ballot questions. So right now, I would like to welcome to the studio in our food segment my favorite butcher, Joe Bucciarelli, and his brother Armando from our from Bucciarelli's butcher shop and deli, or deli and butcher shop. I'm sorry.
It's a butcher shop and deli.
Okay.
Thanks for having us, Joe.
You're very welcome. So I think I told you in the store last time I was in to buy a sandwich that when I first moved to Newburyport, my biggest complaint was I couldn't get a decent Italian sandwich anywhere. And you changed that. So tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to own a butcher shop and deli.
Well, it's actually kind of a unique story.
Speak way up and get right close to the microphone.
All right. Actually, when growing up, I grew up working in supermarkets, pizza places, sub shops, all the way through college. I got out of college and actually went into sales and did that for a few years. Always had a dream of opening my own store, taking different things I like from different places and trying to incorporate into one store. Basically, we came up with the idea to do a butcher shop. We came up and we were building the butcher shop, and I had the same problem when we were up here. I couldn't find a good Italian sandwich anywhere, and we weren't initially going to do sandwiches, so going around trying to find a good Italian, we'd find little bologna, chopped onions, and little oil, and that was it. So we decided we had to do sandwiches as well.
Well, thank you for thinking of me.
My pleasure, Joe.
And so how long has the shop been open now?
This is our seventh year.
Okay, you just blew me away, because I was going to say maybe 4 years, but...
Yeah, time flies.
So, and how's it going?
It's going well. We got great customers. We have loyal customers, and we try to, keep adding new items and making it better and better each year.
So, Armando, do you work at the shop?
Yes, I do.
And what do you do?
I am the meat cutter. I prepare all the meats, all the marinades. I tenderize it. If anybody needs a roast... I'm the guy to see tenderloin roast, ribeyes, anything for the holidays. And if you ever need a steak cut a little thicker, a little thinner, call me up. I'll go in the back and do it however you want.
See, if you're going to work at a butcher shop, being the meat cutter, that sounds like the job to have.
Oh, yeah. I'll tell you, I take pride in it. And I'm the main guy, so it really is one of those things that I take a lot of pride in.
Excellent.
So what's the difference between the meat that you might get at Butcherelli's as opposed to a supermarket?
Well, it's a lot of quality. We get like the higher end stuff, more expensive. May not be that good for customers, out of the pocket. But, once you bring it back to the house and you cook it up, then you notice the difference.
There's two main things you want to look at when you're looking at meat. Basically... There's tenderness and marbleization. So when you go to a supermarket and you see a piece of just red meat, it looks good. It's eye-appealing. But what you actually want to check for is the grade. It starts off at select, and then it goes to choice. And then the higher end is prime, which is only about 1% of all meat out there. We pride ourselves on having nothing but the high-end choice into prime. We have all natural prime, which basically means that there's no hormones, antibiotics in that product. You go to a supermarket. The reason why it's less expensive is because it's a lower quality piece of meat. It doesn't really matter about the buying power, whether it's a market basket, stop and shop. We all compete in the same field for that. We just buy the higher quality stuff, and that's what keeps our customers coming back.
So when you talk about marbleization... What exactly does that? I know what that means because I'm a bit of a foodie, but tell us what that means and why that's important.
Well, if you look at like a higher quality piece of steak, you can notice, I almost like to, like a high-end prime steak, like a Kobe or Wagyu, you'll notice it almost looks like a tiger stripes in it. There's a difference between like, tendons going through it or like little pieces of fat. The fat actually gives you the flavor and it makes it more tender as well.
So, Armando, you said you're in charge of all the marinades. So tell us a little bit about that and how that affects and changes the meat.
Oh, that's my favorite part. I mean, we got about six different steak marinades. We got steakhouse, teriyaki, burgundy wine, mango chipotle, garlic pepper, and everything except for the teriyaki is gluten-free. And what we do is I tenderize the meat. I get it in. And I needle it, so it makes it like really, really tender, even tender than it comes in.
When you say needle it, what does that mean?
Well, we put it through a machine that actually like big needles like slam down on it, so it, like it's like hammering it like what you do at home, but it just does it. We do it twice over, so it's really tender.
Yeah, Joe was assuming you made fun of it. Needle it.
Yep, but after we do that, we
look at you now.
You think you're tender now?
So, and does that allow for the marinade to penetrate the meat better?
Exactly. And after I do that, I put into another machine that vacuum seals all the air out, takes all the oxygen out, and I tumble it. So I spin it around with the marinade. So it gets infused in the meat. So the tenderization process and the marination happens within like 15 minutes, as opposed to a couple of days you do it at home.
Well, that's interesting. So there's a lot of work going on in the background besides just what I, if I marinate something at home, I just pour it in the bag and seal it up.
Nope,
you're needling and tumbling, and you mentioned, you know, there's a little bit of a price premium, but you there's value there. There's more being done to the meat, so
when
I bring it home, I don't have to do all that work.
That's right, exactly.
And when you break down the value, you only really add $1 or $2 more per person for your meal.
So the holidays are coming up. I imagine that's a big time of year for you, and you're ramping up for the busy season. So tell us how the holidays affect your business.
Thanksgiving and Christmas are two of the busiest holidays we have. This Thanksgiving, we're offering farm fresh turkeys. There's Bob's Turkey Farm that we actually go down to the turkey farm, pick up the turkeys, and bring them back. They're all natural. We mentioned a little bit about this before. No hormones, no antibiotics. It basically, they're not pumping these birds up. They live a natural life. They're able to walk around and live life as a turkey would be, rather than being stuck in coops the whole time. And we like to say a happy turkey makes a good turkey.
Okay, so that's for Thanksgiving. I imagine there's a different product that's being bought for Christmas and the other holidays.
Yeah, Christmas, we go into the roasts. We offer any type of roast you would like. The more popular ones during Christmas would be prime rib, tenderloin, top sirloin. And we actually do a lot of stuffed pork roast, too. We can butterfly it, roll it up, tie it, so we can do pinwheels. I'll let Armando tell you a little bit more about that.
Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. The pinwheels are my favorite. I get the meat and I butterfly it, so I cut it open flat-wise, so I open it up so it's really flat, and then I lay down cheese, spinach, garlic, roasted red peppers, anything you really want. Then you roll it up and tie it, so it's just like a very flavorful stuffed meat. And like you said, we do it with pork, too, with apple, cranberry, celery, and onion. You know,
would that be for like a crown roast?
Well, crown roast is like a rib roast, so what we do with that is we get bone-in pork roast, and then we like have to cut it down the middle of the bone, and then we bend it back and tie it through. That takes a while to prep. We usually take 24 hours notice for that.
So any special orders you recommend people call ahead, give at least 24 hours. But for Thanksgiving turkeys, are you taking orders now?
We started taking orders last week, believe it or not. It's late Thanksgiving this year.
Oh, I believe it. The Christmas decorations have been up in stores since for the last 3 weeks. So I believe you're taking Thanksgiving orders. So how would someone – we're talking with Joe and Armando Bucciarelli from Bucciarelli's Butcher Shop and Deli. How would someone go about placing an order for Thanksgiving turkey?
You could either call us at 978-518-3131. Or you could stop down at our store location, 147 Bridge Road. We're right in between Honeydew Donuts and Maypow Restaurant. Just come in, talk to us. We'll be able to go through the different sizes. We also offer homemade prepared sides for that, whether it be, you know, squash, Brussels sprouts, mashed potatoes, anything, stuffing, anything you'd want with your Thanksgiving dinner. And the best thing about that is we can portion for it, whether it be a family of two to a family of 30, we can accommodate you.
Well, we didn't even get a chance to talk about the sandwiches, which is really why I brought you in. But just, let it be said, you want a good Italian sandwich. The bread makes a sandwich. You've got great bread. The meats are great. And they'll make whatever kind of sandwich you want at the counter there, and it's reasonable. So I'm sorry we're almost out of time, but Joe and Armando, thank you so much for coming in. If you go into Bucciarelli's this weekend, tell them you heard it on, mention that you heard them on Local Pulse on WNBP, and I'd just like to remind everyone there's been a change up in the schedule here at WNBP. So right afterwards, Jeff Duford will be in to play the Legends for you. Tonight, at 1 p.m., there's the high school Clippers game. They're playing Pentucket. And then at 4 o'clock will be Dave Mack playing the Rock and Roll Oldies Party. And don't forget about the doo-wop party at the Winner's Circle tonight in Salisbury. Until next week, my name is Joe DBAs. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you next week in our election wrap-up edition of Local Pulse on WNBP.